Welcome and thank you very much for joining us on episode 121 of the Blazers Edge podcast, presented to you today by BlazersEdge.com. I'm your weekend host, Chris Lucia.
And I'm your weekend co-host, Brandon Goldner. You can always reach us by email at blazersedgepodcast@gmail.com. We'd appreciate your subscription and your ratings on both iTunes and Stitcher. And we also wanted to say that we're starting to use our YouTube account. So if you wanted to check that out, you can find the Blazers Edge Weekend Podcast every weekend on our YouTube account. And we'd appreciate your subscription.
And there will be a link in the news post for that. So check that out for sure. Joining us today on the Blazers Edge Weekend Podcast is Blazers Edge staff writer Eric Griffith. Eric, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you back. It's been a spell. It's been a couple weeks. Has it been a month already?
Yeah, I was worried you guys were tired of me. I thought I might be banned as a regular guest.
Yeah, we pretty much were sick of you. That's why we had to take a breather.
No, that would never happen, man. You're like one of the most regular guys on the podcast, Eric, so we're always happy to have you.
You're basically a third host.
So we're recording this on a Friday night, as is customary, but this time we're doing it after the game, and there isn't a game coming up until Sunday. So this is one of those lucky times on the Blazers Edge Weekend podcast where we actually kind of can go into some timely content, and that is the New Orleans Pelicans game that occurred Friday night between the Blazers and They almost choked it away, guys. So, you know, I'm looking at this game. The Blazers score, you know, 67 points in the first half. It looked like they kind of had it tucked away. I think, you know, I was thinking pretty much at halftime, all right, this is going to be kind of a cruise to victory kind of a game. You know, even though it was the second out of a back-to-back, you got kind of a banged up, you know, New Orleans squad, you know, putting Tim Frazier out there, you know, playing some pretty heavy minutes. So, it's always good to see him, but you didn't think it was going to be a very competitive game. And then all of a sudden, this ragtag group of pretty much former Blazers gets together. Who do we got? Tim Frazier, Alonzo G, Dante Cunningham. Luke Babbitt was in there late in the game in the fourth quarter for the Pelicans.
Chalupa Cabra.
Shout out to Ben Golliver.
Right. keeping him in the game. And it came down to, you know, personally, what I would imagine would be a little too close to comfort for most Blazer fans. And it was kind of, the Pelicans took the lead there in the last couple minutes, and it looked like the Blazers might actually choke that one away. So I guess I'll throw this out to you guys. After the Blazers scored 67 in the first half, they scored only 50 in the second half, and they weren't able to pull away until the very, very last several moments of the game. So what kind of went wrong there in the second half for the Blazers, Brandon? Did you notice anything with the team that they changed, or did the Pelicans really just kind of turn it up? What really happened there?
I mean, it's tough to tell all that happened. It should be said that it was interesting because not only is this Pelicans team not super good this year, but they were without the services of Anthony Davis down the stretch, who went down with some kind of weird knee injury. So, I mean, obviously, without your best player, you would have thought the Blazers up by 20 points would have been sitting pretty, but that wasn't the case. Both Drew Holiday and Ryan Anderson had 30 points. Anderson did that off the bench. So, I mean, Anderson was lighting it up. Drew Holiday was playing super, super well. There were a couple times where he was making consecutive shots. The second of one of those consecutive shots was with Damian Lillard playing pretty good defense right up in his grill, following him bounce for bounce on a step back, and he made it anyway. So, I mean, I don't know. It was tough to watch, but I have to say one way you could look at it is that the Blazers got the experience of building a big lead. That's a great experience to have. And then they got the experience of grinding out a gritty game. I mean, if you were to take the Men in Black memory flashers and just kind of put it up to your face and you're down two late on the road, who cares if it's not a great team? That's a good win to get. I mean, Eric, what do you think?
I think that might be a little bit over-optimistic. You're absolutely right. There's the old adage that a win is a win, so by extension, any win is a good win. When you're in the middle of a playoff hunt, any win is a great win, maybe. That being said, the Blazers, it seemed like, after a first half where New Orleans played almost no defense, they were in no way trying to challenge Lillard, McCollum, or anyone else from scoring. It seemed like when when New Orleans decided to actually turn on their defensive pressure, to actually play with some kind of intensity, especially in the fourth quarter, it seemed like the Blazers had kind of been lulled into a false sense of security where they're looking and saying, all right, our lead's 16, we're ahead, we're good enough that we're not too worried about this. And so they kind of got lax and started settling for perimeter jumpers and maybe not the best offensive options they had. I'm not too worried about that because I think a wake-up call for this team, they're aware that they're at 500. They're aware that they're not the San Antonio Spurs, and so they can't let a team get back to 8 and just kind of cruise with that 8-point lead to victory. So I'm not too worried that will become a trend, but at the same time, it was annoying to see tonight, I'll say.
Do any of you guys watch the League Pass broadcast of the game to where you heard the Pelicans broadcast tonight?
Yes, I did.
Do you guys notice that their broadcasters, the nickname, of course I would bring up something like this, for Ryan Anderson is freaking Flamethrower?
That's so much better than Cool Breeze. That's a cool nickname.
All right, now you're just baiting me into an argument here. I see what's going on.
I would never do that.
Right, like Flamethrower?
Ryan Anderson, actually, I felt like he kind of helped the Blazers because in the first half, in the first quarter, what was it, like 36-30 after one, and neither team was playing any defense. It looked like the 1985 Denver Nuggets were in the building. And then Flamethrower, which is a great nickname, comes out there and starts burning up the defense. And the Blazers kind of snapped into it and were like, oh, crap, we are letting Ryan Anderson tear us to shreds. And that's when they really started to separate themselves, was when they started to kind of pick up the intensity because Ryan Anderson was hitting a few shots, I feel like.
What about Drew Holiday? I think, what was it, 33 points? Was 30 points for him tonight? I mean, a lot of those points came in the second half. Do we think that maybe he just kind of heated up and it was more or less his night? Or did the Blazers kind of just fail to stop him? Or was it kind of a combination of both?
Well, I will say, despite the fact that I did see Lillard playing some pretty good defense at times, I think that he's still sick. I mean, wasn't Lillard battling like a chest cold a couple days ago? There were times during the game, and it was tweeted about from the Blazers Edge Twitter account run by me, that he looked like he was still struggling with that chest cold, that his conditioning wasn't where he wanted it to be. And I wonder if maybe that had something to do with it. I mean, I also thought that I saw CJ playing defense on Holiday down the stretch, and you will see the Blazers do that pretty often. If the opposing point guard is lighting Dame up, they're going to switch McCollum on that person at least for a while, and that happens quite a bit. But, I mean, what do you make of Kendrick Perkins? He got ejected with like 7 minutes to go in the game.
I mean, what can you say about Kendrick Perkins? I mean,
he's an enforcer, says LeBron.
Sure. I mean, I think like if you want to call like playing in a way that's unsafe for other players at times, sure, you can call that an enforcer. I mean, personally, I'm not particularly a big fan of the dude and kind of his antics on the court. So I don't know. I'm not. I guess I'll call him an enforcer, kind of a bully kind of a guy. But I mean, at this point in his career, I think that's the best you're going to get from Kendrick Perkins, is kind of that goon role. I don't think he's really good for much else.
I mean,
the thing that annoyed me a little bit more about that too was it didn't seem like anything happened that led to that. It wasn't like the Matt Barnes situation the other night where the players had been, you know, kind of building up a beef all night. It was just kind of totally out of the blue. He just seemed to clothesline Dame running down the lane for no reason whatsoever. And that kind of got under my skin a little bit.
It looked like a super lazy foul. Like a lazy, dumb, dangerous foul.
And that's actually what I believe his name is Joel Myers, the New Orleans play-by-play guy, was like, oh, that was an accident. He just, you know, he forgot how big he was compared to Damian Lillard. And so it seems like the New Orleans argument was, you know what, he just kind of is bad at fouling and accidentally fouled too hard, which I don't know if I personally buy, but it's worth mentioning, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and when I say like a lazy, dumb foul, I don't even mean like, oh, like he doesn't know his strength, like, oh my goodness, oops. I mean like he was, you know, he's huge, he knows he's huge, you know, he doesn't have any discernible talent other than being giant and bullying people around. And it just seemed kind of like a lazy, loping kind of swipe. And I don't know. I'm not a fan of plays like that. I'm glad that he was ejected. It should be mentioned that Damian Lillard went on a bit of a cold streak after that. So that was about 7.5 minutes to go in the game, and the Blazers were still up by 10 at that point. And after that, after Perkins got ejected for essentially clotheslining Lillard, Lillard missed a three. Then he turned the ball over. He fouled someone. He missed a lay-in. And it's just like, I mean, I don't think that you can say that Lillard being hit by Perkins is the reason why he went on a very, you know, brief cold spell. But I think that people like Kendrick Perkins think that that has something to do with it. And I'm guessing that he was probably sitting in the locker room chuckling as the Pelicans, you know, they were down 10, then they were down 8, down 6, and eventually, you know, closed the gap.
Well, I don't know about in the locker room chuckling, but I will, just so we don't give the wrong impression about Damian's game tonight. He finished with 33 points on 19 field goal attempts, which is just incredible efficiency.
12 free throws. 8 rebounds,
6 assists, and then he also had the game-clinching penetrate and dish out to C.J. McCollum for the wide-open three, where he just absorbed. He must have drawn in like 4 defenders simultaneously, so... You're right, Dame went on that cold spell, but he was indispensable tonight offensively.
And you know what's incredible is that to my eye, Damian Lillard, again, he looked like a little bit sick, a little bit not quite himself, and he still performed just as well as you just described. I mean, that's pretty cool. It's always nice when you see someone who's like not quite passing the eye test, and then you look at their impact and you're like, wow, this is a player not quite at their best. That's pretty cool.
You know who really kind of bailed the Blazers out, I thought, tonight, and probably more often than we had thought would happen earlier on in the season, is Gerald Henderson. I think later on in the game, you were mentioning that they took Dame off of Holiday when he was on fire and when the flamethrower was on fire as well. They took Dame off of Jrue Holiday. I think Gerald Henderson also cross-matched a little bit when Holiday was starting to heat up. So he kind of put the clamps down on Holiday on a couple of possessions later on in the game there. And then there was that bailout long two-pointer in the corner where pretty much had what I thought no chance of making it. Ends up making it. I think did it put the Blazers up one or tie the game? At any rate, I think that's kind of the point where the Blazers kind of were able to kind of salt the game away. So I think Gerald Henderson deserves a decent amount of credit for kind of keeping the Blazers in it with his late game play against the Pelicans on Friday.
Yeah, and actually, you know, definitely his late game play, and also not just his late game play. Gerald Henderson looked really good. I mean, I'm one of Gerald Henderson's, you know, greatest detractors. I'm not actually a huge fan of how he's played this year, but I thought he had a very, very solid game. He looked super active, super energetic. I know this is cliche to Blazers fans by now, but he really looks like he's recovered from that hip surgery. Like, he looked bouncy. He was active on offense and defense. He wasn't just taking those classic Gerald Henderson, you know, fading jumpers on the baseline with three guys draped on him. I mean, he was like driving and trying to dunk and, you know, being pushed in midair by Kendrick Perkins. Thanks a lot, Kendrick Perkins. I really like the way that Gerald Henderson played. And I don't think that you can expect, you know, 19-6 from him every night. And the Blazers probably don't need 19-6 from him every night, but it was really good to see.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right, Brandon, where he was super, super aggressive. He had 8 free throws and 6 rebounds, which for a bench player, he played 28 minutes tonight. But for a guard bench player to pick up that many free throws and that many rebounds is, you know, it's one of the times where the numbers don't lie, and you can tell that he was, you know, getting after it tonight. So here's the follow-up question, gentlemen, and I'm going to spring this one on you. Is Gerald Henderson the Blazers' third guard going forward? What do you think about this summer and Gerald Henderson?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he's their third guard moving forward, but it seems like Gerald Henderson in the Blazers system, he does provide something super valuable, which I think is sort of the same thing that Allen Crabbe and Myers Leonard provide, which is just, I mean, Allen Crabbe maybe a little bit more so for his defense. And actually, Gerald Henderson has historically been a decent defender, because I was just about to say that they give you that kind of confident offense off the bench. And then I realized that Myers isn't particularly confident on offense, so really I'm just going to pick apart my entire argument I was about to make. But I don't think that he fits as well with the Blazers system as he would with another team that wanted him to be more like a Mo Williams or maybe a Jamal Crawford kind of microwave role. That's what I see Gerald Henderson doing really well, and I'm not sure if the Blazers system is good for a player like him off the bench.
Do you mean in the way that he kind of to be effective offensively, or to be optimally effective for his skill set, he kind of needs to have the ball in his hands a little bit and create off the dribble, and that kind of goes against the flow of Terry Stotts' offense, or how we traditionally would expect it to flow?
I think you nailed it right there. I think the Blazers' offense is a flowy offense, even off the bench, which is pretty, I mean, that's one of those things where it's like the whole is greater than the sum of its parts on the bench. You could have a bunch of players like Gerald Henderson who are kind of like have a system off the bench where it's like, you know, each really good player takes their turn with the ball and kind of gets to do what they want to do with a possession, and then someone else gets to do what they want to do for a possession. But I mean, the basketball is so sticky in Gerald Henderson's hands that it doesn't lend itself to a Portland Trailblazers offense, either, you know, starters or off the bench. So I think that you pretty much nailed it, Chris.
Is it worth it to have a kind of change of pace guy, though, who doesn't necessarily he doesn't score in the same way that the rest of the team kind of does in the framework of the offense? I mean, you know, like Jamal Crawford, it's basically Jamal Ball when he's out there. The Clippers kind of know that. I'm not saying it would be to that degree, or it is in Portland with Gerald Henderson. It's not even close to that. But in terms of just kind of switching it up and being a little bit different stylistically from the way that they traditionally play, like if it's not working the way that they normally play, it's a really effective weapon to bring someone off the bench who can, you know, if a team is really going to give you the mid-range, there's no better guy than Gerald Henderson to take advantage of teams giving you shots off the dribble in the mid-range, I would think.
So I see what you're saying, but I think I'm going to disagree a little bit and say that Gerald Henderson would be a great, like, final addition to a team. Like, you know, you're looking for that last piece to make that push, like maybe an Aaron Aflalo type acquisition that, you know, turns out well. But right now the Blazers have some pretty serious holes in their backcourt, and so I think it's more, and I totally agree with you guys where I don't know necessarily about his long-term fit, because I think they have bigger holes in the backcourt. Specifically, they still need a third playmaker / point guard / ball handler / whatever, so that if Dame or CJ, God forbid, misses 10 games, or God forbid are in foul trouble repeatedly, they're not relying entirely on an individual player. And I don't think Henderson is that safety valve where he can be that third ball handler or that guy who's always on the court with CJ to make sure there's always two players to respond to a full court press or whatever in there.
So you don't think that Brian Roberts could be that player?
I don't know. I don't think we've seen him enough. I think they decided that Tim Frazier wasn't that player, and we've seen that Tim Frazier actually is doing really well in New Orleans the last couple games. And Brian Roberts reportedly might even be better than Tim Frazier, but I think the sample size with the Blazers at this point is too small, at least for me as a, you know, semi-obsessed fan, to make any kind of proper judgment.
Brian Roberts is 30 years old.
Wow.
So his, I think his rookie season, he was like 25 or 26, because he played, I think he played overseas for a number of years before he caught on with an NBA team after college. So he's 30 years old now. So that's, I don't know, that's not necessarily in line with, you know, Dame, CJ, some of the younger guys on the team in terms of the curve that they're on, in terms of age. So, I mean, he's a game manager, though. I mean, he's a capable point guard who's not going to turn the ball over a ton. He's not a great shooter. He's a decent shooter. Not prone to making a ton of mistakes. A solid vet guy. I mean, it's always nice to have one of those around, but I think, you know, going into this summer, I think what Eric's kind of saying is maybe someone a little more, I don't want to use the needle mover cliche, so someone a little more you would expect to be more impactful consistently for the Blazers, and maybe in line with that arc that Dame and CJ are kind of on.
And not even necessarily more impactful than Gerald Henderson, but differently impactful. I really think that you know, the team is at their best when Dame and CJ are playing together. I think adding a third guy who was like, you know, a poor man's Dame and CJ, maybe a little bigger so play a little better defense, but in that way you can always have two guards on the floor who can share ball handling and playmaking duties, basically two combo guards who are true combo guards. I think having two guys like that on the floor would make the Blazers' offense way more diverse, way more effective, and way more dangerous for opposing teams.
Is there anyone around the league who kind of fits that role? Is kind of a sixth man kind of type guard? I'm not saying throw it out a hypothetical for the Blazers to chase after or anything. I'm just saying kind of a model type player that the Blazers could or should be looking for to kind of bolster that backcourt this offseason. Do any names come to mind off the top of anyone's head? I mean, Isaiah Thomas, kind of a guy. I mean, that would be a real impact, but you know, a guy like that's going to command a lot of money. I mean, obviously, and that's not going to be willing to come off the bench. I mean, who out there it really fills that role, but isn't going to command a ton of money and is willing to come off the bench? I personally wonder if that guy really is out there.
All right, so while you were playing me in so artfully, I pulled up a little internet website on my mobile telephonic device, and we're going through the top free agents of 2016 at the point guard position. So let's just run down this list. Number one, Mike Conley. Yes or no?
Out. I mean,
okay, so he's out, so we're not even going to talk about that. Number two, Rajon Rondo.
No.
Jordan Clarkson.
No.
Jeremy Lin.
No.
Deron Williams.
No.
Jeremy Lin's going to be too expensive, but he would be perfect.
How is he going to be too expensive? What has he done lately to earn any amount of money, even considering the salary cap?
Dope hair,
yes. That's definitely true.
Totally not being honest with that. No, I think he has the worst hair in the league, hands down.
Charlotte's also spiking, no pun intended, at the moment.
I see what you did there.
Yeah. And I think they're 15-3 or something, just absurdly insane. And Michael Jordan, you know, the leader of the Charlotte Hornets, has proven that he's willing to overpay guys to win immediately, even if it means you're going to win 45 or 50 games. So I think it's going to take, and he's been an integral piece off their bench, playing with Batum and playing with Kemba Walker, and he fits really well in their system as well. So I think it's going to take a lot to pry him away from Charlotte, and he seems to like it there too.
Let's not forget that any team who gets a star player from China or of Chinese descent, like Jeremy Lin, you know, that's a huge, huge like way to gain viewership internationally. I mean, if you just talk about Chinese players or write about them, and we've noticed this on Blazers Edge before, writing about Yao Ming or talking about Jeremy Lin, you can see an uptick in the traffic of that. I mean, that's a real demographic that a team could potentially tap into for marketing. So I think Jeremy Lin is attractive for a number of reasons, not only because of what he can do on the court, but also because there's just a huge demographic that's interested in following him.
All right, so Jeremy Lin, let's see, we go through number seven, Ty Lawson. I don't think anyone wants to touch Ty Lawson. Mo Williams, you take another spin on the Mo Williams wheel?
At 34, I don't think so.
All right, so Mario Chalmers.
We're scraping
the ball bottom of the barrel at this point.
Where's Andre Miller on your list?
Oh, I got to keep scrolling to find. By the way, I mean, that's such a great, I love it. I love 39-year-old Andre Miller puttering around with the Spurs. There couldn't be a better fit. That is a match made in heaven. I'm absolutely A+, two thumbs up. I'm totally on board with that.
He started a game for them and they won.
Andre Miller started a game for the Spurs and they won.
How do they play defense with him on the court? I mean, his defense is at this point, and I mean, it wasn't when he was younger in his career on the Blazers in his early 30s, it was never that great. But at 39, I've seen him get blown by a couple times where it looks like he might as well not even try.
You know what? Gandalf was pretty old too, and he was pretty powerful. I mean, it's clear Andre Miller is a wizard. That's why he's still playing.
You know, while we're talking about the Spurs, I'm going to take advantage and make a segue into CJ McCollum's performance against them on Thursday night. We're recording on Friday night, so it's very fresh in my mind. And what CJ McCollum did to the San Antonio Spurs defense in the first half of that game was nothing short of incredible. He basically shredded them in every way that you possibly need or possibly can shred a defense of that caliber. He was reading it on the fly, and he was making perfect spot-on passes to the open man. He was exploiting the holes that the Spurs leave open, specifically the mid-range game. So he was splitting double teams and and jumping into the middle of the court to take his floaters, which is an area where the Spurs don't prioritize defensively. It got to the point that Coach Popovich had to pull Danny Green off of him and put Kawhi Leonard on him, which is something he usually avoids doing, especially in the first half. He usually avoids cross matches like that. But at one point after CJ drew a foul on Danny Green, Pop basically threw his hands up and said, all right, we got to put Kawhi on him.
CJ has been absolutely phenomenal this year offensively. I think he's definitely front runner for MIP. I mean, at this point, no one's going to argue with that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I would hope so.
I mean, so he's putting opposing defenses on roller skates. This is a regular thing for them. I am impressed, though, you know, against the Spurs. You brought this up, Eric. You know, they're normally not a team that's necessarily going to adjust to what you're doing, or they're not necessarily going to change, you know, their strategy mid-game that drastically in terms of cross-matching. But just having to throw Kawhi on a guy like CJ, you know, you're talking about the NBA's defensive player of the year, right? I mean, CJ commanding that type of attention from a team like the Spurs, a team like Kawhi Leonard, and a coach like Greg Popovich, that speaks volumes to me for where CJ Colum is now as a player.
Yeah, and he continued to do a great job even with Kawhi on him. I'm thinking you guys remember that play where he bamboozled James Harden and like spun him around in circles when the Blazers were playing the Rockets. He ran the same action against Kawhi, got a switch, and allowed Mason Plumlee to score an easy basket off of it. So even Kawhi Leonard was occasionally, obviously he was playing good defense against him, but was occasionally struggling. And that was so essential to the Blazers staying in that game in the first half, because the Spurs were all over Damian Lillard. It was stop Damian Lillard or bust. And it would have been easy for CJ McCollum to, you know, fall into the same trappings that other players have fallen into against the Spurs defense. You know, it's one of the top three defenses of the last 20 years. But instead, he responded and more or less picked it apart. And he would not have done that even, I would say, 3 or 4 months ago. And so it's a huge sign of maturation on his part, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and any time you have a second weapon that you can rely on, obviously Damian Lillard is by far and away the Blazers' best player. And if teams are just content on stopping your best player and kind of letting everyone else do whatever they do, that's not really a recipe for a winning team. So if you have a second player who can really take that pressure off, who can bend that defense, who can make those defensive players think a little bit more about what CJ McCollum's doing and then relax a bit on Damian Lillard, and then the shots start opening up for Damian Lillard, and the passing lanes open up, and then he can drive, and then he can drive and kick out, then he can drive and run all the way around and then have the ball, you know, whip around the perimeter. So, I mean, basketball is a game of moves and counter moves. And so if you are just packing Damian Lillard, if you have someone else that can take that pressure off, that's essentially the next move in the chess game that is basketball. It allows everything else to open up.
So we're talking about, you know, CJ being able to take a bit of the pressure off of Damian Lillard when they're on the court together. And Eric, you wrote about this pretty early on in the season, when CJ was kind of struggling a little bit when he was, you know, the only ball handler on the floor when Dame was on the bench early on. I mean, we saw, like, wasn't it kind of across the board his stats kind of dipped? I mean, effective field goal percentage, true shooting percentage, scoring average, assists. I think the turnovers were up a little bit. I mean, regardless, he wasn't playing as well when he didn't have Damian alongside him on the floor. And you kind of talked about that earlier on in the season, Eric. And then I think it was about game 67 or 68, you decided to kind of re-examine the subject there. And you kind of found out, you know, a couple of interesting tidbits there about how CJ is kind of functioning in the Blazers offense without Damian Lillard. So what kind of developments have happened for CJ as he's kind of progressed through the season and gotten maybe more comfortable without having Damian on the floor with him?
Yeah, so what you're talking about is since Christmas, so since about December 26th, you know, the game when they beat the crap out of the Cavs, CJ's numbers with Lillard off the court have gone through the roof. His effective field goal percentage is up to 54%. Before it was 39%. His offensive rating has gone from 92 to 110. His usage has stayed pretty much constant, so it's not like all of a sudden he's deferring more often, maybe to Henderson or Harkless or whoever. He still has the ball in his hands all the time, but he's just doing a way better job at scoring efficiently, basically. And what's really cool about that is that it seems to have coincided with the improvement of the bench. And Myers Leonard specifically, and then also Alan Crabb, their three-point shooting went up, and at the same time, McCollum's efficiency went up. And so there's some kind of, in my, you know, my armchair analysis of it, my Monday morning quarterbacking of it, is that there's some kind of synergy going on between CJ and a couple of the other bench players, where when those guys are hitting their shots, it opens up the floor for CJ, and then if they try to collapse back in, CJ kicks out in threes, and Myers Leonard and Crabb are now shooting 40%+.
I mean, I think it's awesome that CJ is playing better, you know, without having to play alongside Damian Lillard. It's obviously better the bench is playing better. But I think it begs the question, Eric, how is Portland as a team playing since that same point? Are they playing any better?
Yeah, and I hinted at it, but you're right. I didn't explicitly say it. The team is playing much better without Lillard on the court. Their offensive rating without Lillard on the court since CJ has improved has gone from 97 to 111. Which is the equivalent of going from, I think it was going from 30th to 2nd or something. So we're talking, you're moving from like the Los Angeles Lakers to the San Antonio Spurs improvement with Lillard off the floor since CJ's turned his game around.
So you're basically saying that the Blazers should dump Lillard right now.
Yes, I'm saying the Blazers should challenge all of the other bench units in the NBA to a special tournament to determine the final playoff seeds.
You know, I think the headline of this podcast should be Eric Griffith, colon, thinks that Damian Lillard should be traded. No, and that's incredible to see, and it's incredible what you can do if you put the time in and research some of this stuff. You can suss some of this stuff out and just see how much better he's gotten. And it's amazing to see. It's not just in the statistics, right? It's passing the eye test too. I mean, you watch CJ McCollum play now. He's playing with so much more confidence. I mean, I don't know if there's been too many times this season when I've kind of felt uncomfortable or kind of cringy when CJ McCollum has had the ball and primary ball handling duties, but it's not only to the point where you don't feel uncomfortable when he's doing that. I mean, you feel super confident that he's going to make something happen, and it's probably going to be something good. And so, I mean, just to add a little bit of, you know, eye testiness to the statistical analysis that you're bringing.
So, Brandon, have you noticed anything then has your eye test noticed anything about CJ's aggressiveness, especially around the rim? Is he still entirely reliant on his mid-range game, or do you think he's diversified a little bit, according to your eye?
Well, I definitely think that he has been more aggressive. He's been trying to collect more contact at the rim and not just avoid contact. I mean, I don't actually have the numbers in front of me right now, and maybe you have a better sense of this. CJ McCollum never seems to have drawn too many fouls in his career. It doesn't seem like he's drawn a ton of fouls even through this year, but lately it seems like that has been changing. And I just want to say this, isn't it pretty remarkable that a guy can average over 20 points in this league and not be someone who gets the line constantly? I'm looking at a player like James Harden. He's really easy to make fun of. Part of his game is that he intentionally draws fouls in various ways. But no, CJ McCollum, I mean, again, I'm not looking at it, but I don't think he gets to the line all that often, at least not on the whole this year. But yeah, lately it has seemed like he's been trying to draw that contact out more. And I think that part of it too is as CJ McCollum's star rises in the league, and I don't think this is something that we necessarily want to admit, but it's true that the more prominence you have as an NBA player, the more fairly, or depending on how you look at it, more unfairly you'll be treated by the refs. I mean, unfairly in your favor. The better that CJ McCollum gets and the more respect that he gets around the league, it's going to be easier for him to draw fouls. So why wouldn't he try to draw more contact? Now is the perfect time to do it. And it's, I mean, I've seen the same thing in Damian Lillard's career, right? I mean, it seems, and we had Dane Carbaugh on the show a little bit ago, and he said that the data doesn't actually play out that Damian Lillard is receiving more fouls. I don't think his foul rate is all that much higher, but it seems to me that he is better at seeking out that contact and getting the line, and that's the same thing for CJ McCollum. At least that's what it seems like lately.
Yeah, and I think you make a really good point. And so I definitely have seen the same thing where he's trying to draw fouls now. There's been a couple plays where he's, like, actively, like, tried to, like, body into someone and do, like, the CP3 style, like, oh, you hit me move. And it hasn't worked for him yet. But you know what? I have learned to never underestimate what CJ McCollum can improve, even within the season. So I have a feeling that 6 months from now we're going to be saying, wow, CJ McCollum's drawing 8 free throws. Or I shouldn't say that. CJ McCollum's drawing way more free throws than he used to.
Yeah, and I mean, one of those moves, like you were talking about, it's those, just like you said, Eric, those crafty Chris Paul veteran offensive moves. The one that I can see CJ has been doing more of, he is quick enough and has good enough handles to get around his defensive assignment, and then you kind of dribble in front of him, and then you kind of stop, and then you kind of jump up and jump backwards a little bit and kind of like throw your legs and arms out and go, whoa, and like put the ball up and you try to draw the foul essentially by jumping backwards but not making it look like you're jumping backwards. We all know that move. We've seen that move 1,000 times. He is getting better at that. And I think also, and this is kind of sports science cliche, if you will, but as CJ McCollum gets stronger, he's going to be better not only at drawing contact but finishing off that contact. The amount of strength, now this is very cliche, the amount of core strength that it takes to hang in the air and keep your balance while you're holding the ball until just the right time, such as you feel that contact and then you let go. Like the longer you can hang in the air and hold your balance and kind of, you know, kind of frame that foul, the more successful you'll be at drawing those fouls. It's kind of like in baseball, you know, like, and apologies for our fans who don't like baseball at all, when the pitcher throws the pitch and the catcher catches it and then he moves the glove a little bit, and they call that, you know, framing the pitch to try to show the umpire, oh, hey, it's totally a strike. It's the same thing in basketball. I mean, the way that you move your body and the way that you frame that foul for the officials, that's something that comes with time, and that's something that CJ McCollum has gotten better with this year.
And, you know, watching Damian Lillard, he actually has clearly emphasized in recent weeks drawing more fouls. It's been a major point of emphasis for him, and he's done a lot of those Chris Paul moves that you just perfectly described, or as well as we can describe verbally. And he's been really, really effective at them. And a common trait for Damian Lillard and Chris Paul is that for dudes who are only 6 feet tall or 6'3", or whatever they claim to be in the land of giants, those two are like strong as oxes. And they often, you can see them like, you know, bodying up to guys who are 6'6", 6'7", and really challenging them in the post. And I think what you're hitting on here is that Damian Lillard has adapted to those moves that maybe the coaching staff is even emphasizing in practice, is my guess, because it seems too coincidental that both Lillard and McCollum are trying to do the same thing at the same time, and it's not a point of emphasis. And I'm thinking that you're right, that one of the reasons Dame has adapted to it so much more quickly than CJ is Dame has that, you know, he has more of an NBA body because he's been in the league for a couple more years. And that's something that, you know, maybe he learned from Chris Paul, and something that CJ, though, can definitely develop in the offseason.
And one thing that makes you hopeful about that, just the kind of how big are you? I mean, look at pictures of CJ McCollum when he was in college.
First when he was a years. Freshman in high school. Look at those pictures.
Oh, no. Oh,
he
no.
Was 5'2".
He looks like a little boy.
100 pounds. It was his uniform is like hanging off of him.
Yeah. And it's incredible to see that, like, I mean, he's not huge by any stretch at all, but, like, you know, he doesn't look flimsy at this point. And, you know, give him a couple more years and you can see that he's going to put on some bulk. I mean, I think that there are other things too that can, I mean, you don't want to become too bulky. I mean, that's something that a player like LaMarcus Aldridge said for a long time, why he, like, no, he's 6'11". Why don't you get humongous and just throw people around? And he claimed that the reason why he didn't want to get too bulky was he didn't want to lose his mobility. He didn't want to lose his speed. You could make the same argument for guards, that there's like a limit. There's a point at which you don't want to get any bigger, especially considering your height. But I think CJ McCollum could still definitely fill out his frame a bit.
Eric Bledsoe. Look at that dude. I mean, that guy is pretty stacked physically, but in terms of quickness, I mean, he can't stay healthy and stay on the court to save his life. But in terms of quickness and speed and agility, he's got that frame, that pretty big frame for a point guard. And he's got all those tools. I mean, so I guess that's the one guy who comes to mind if we're talking about, you know, really big, bulky point guards, pretty much who can play physically aggressive and can play super fast. But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, there's probably a point of diminishing returns when it comes to how much these guys actually do want to bulk up. I mean, that's kind of, I mean, I guess it wouldn't be a terrible thing. I mean, if we're talking about finishing through contact, though, I mean, I get both Dame and CJ do look much more well built than they did in college and in their rookie season. So that's something that they're definitely putting into their offseason regimen. And I read from CJ, actually, he has his program where he helps local Portland area high school students get into journalism. And they were asking him questions after a game. And one of the questions they asked was, what was his pregame meal? And it was like a plate of ravioli and some pasta and then like cups of vegetables. It was like a ridiculous amount. It was like as much food as one of us would eat in a day is like his pregame meal. So, you know, if the,
well, how long before the game is that pregame meal coming? Did it mention that? Didn't your mom ever tell you don't swim in the pool 30 minutes after you eat? Isn't that the same thing? You don't want to go into an NBA game 30 minutes after you eat a meal like that.
Well, I think if you do this 82 times a year, your body can kind of get used to it and you're probably able to use it, the energy, more efficiently. But at any rate, the point I'm trying to make is that CJ is like, this is something that he's definitely keeping in mind as I'm looking at the response to that question from the kid about what he eats. Looking at his diet before the game, the dude's definitely like is placing a pretty high value on bulking up a little bit, if that's any indication. But we talked about a little earlier the way that he was developing a little bit of synergy with some of the bench players. And I want to talk about Myers Leonard because he was kind of brought up. And I don't think we're going to be able to change anybody's minds, nor should we try to. You know, you've heard this from a number of beat reporters. I know Casey and Joe on the Rip City Report talk about this too when they get Myers Leonard questions, is that he's the most polarizing guy on the team. You either pretty much think he's, you know, worth keeping around, or you think that the Blazers should have gotten rid of him yesterday in terms of the way that he kind of splits the fan base. But, you know, there's kind of maybe, you know, we're thinking about this, and you hear a lot of talk about, should Myers be starting? I've heard some pundits say he needs to develop a post game. We heard early on in the season, this was preseason, there were a number of reporters, some national, calling him a basketball unicorn, quote unquote, for his ability to hit threes as a 7-footer, but also defend the rim on the defensive end of the court. So there's all kinds of opinions about Myers Leonard, all kinds of expectations that we had for him going into this season. I guess my question to you guys is, do you think there maybe should we take a step back a little bit with Myers Leonard? Do you think maybe we kind of put the cart in front of the horse when we started talking about, you know, his contract earlier on in the season, about, because, you know, I remember definitely on the podcast we said the dude is likely going to command 10, 12, even, you know, 13, 14, 15 million a year maybe this offseason, based on the astronomical way that the salary cap in the NBA is going up and most teams having money. A lot of guys are going to get overpaid. So, you know, we were talking about, you know, 12, 13 million a year for this guy. I think maybe now, and Eric's kind of mentioned this, we've kind of kicked this around back and forth off air, and we've been talking about this in the group chat that we have. You know, maybe we're judging Myers Leonard based on that hypothetical 12, 13, 14 million that we were talking about early on in the season. And if you look at it that way, it's easy to be, I think it's very easy to be disappointed in him if that's what you're expecting. But is there a way that we should change how we view Myers Leonard going forward that could maybe, that would suit more what he actually does bring to the team, or is the jury out on him? What do you guys really think about that?
So I think the thing with Myers Leonard is the expectations, where coming into the season, he was expected to be, you know, he started as the starting power forward for the first six games or however many games. And since then, this season at least, it's become pretty apparent that he is not necessarily cut out to be the starting power forward of a title contending team. Maybe the fifth starter, but he's definitely not that integral foundational piece that people were hoping going into the season, where we're throwing around the $18 million ideas. But what we do see is that he definitely has a couple bankable NBA skills. He's a great outside shooter, and he started the season off a little bit cold, but he's since adapted. I think he was shooting 48% or close to it from three in the month of March before he re-aggravated his shoulder injury. And his defensive rebounding is actually excellent. His per 36 numbers as a reserve are right up there with some of the other top reserves in the NBA. I think he was averaging a straight 8 rebounds a game or something since January. And his defensive rebounding percentage in 2016 is actually ahead of Ed Davis. So he has two very bankable skills that I think make him a solid backup player. And once we adjust our expectations and stop thinking of him as LaMarcus Aldridge's replacement and start thinking about him as the first guy off the bench at backup power forward, he'll be great for the Blazers.
Yeah, and if we're judging him in a context that's fair to him, right? I mean, I think that's what pretty much makes the most sense at this point. I think we've seen enough evidence probably where maybe we should, like you said, lower those expectations. And I think, you know, a couple of good examples is if we look at Ed Davis and Mason Plumlee and we look at their limited skill set, but we look at them as really solid role players. They're good at doing, a couple things each. Nobody really asks them to do too much, and nobody's really disappointed when they can't do stuff that's beyond what their skill set would dictate. I think maybe if we kind of judge Myers Leonard in the same way, where we say this is what his skill set is, he has potential to be a solid role player. These are the skills that he's good at, the few skills that he can excel at. Let's judge him based on that. I mean, one difference that stands out to me a little bit, if we're comparing guys like those, Mason Plumlee and Ed Davis to Myers Leonard, is that they don't make, I guess you could probably say they don't make glaring mistakes in the same way that Myers does on both ends of the court. They don't necessarily hesitate the same way. So there's a couple of hitches there to where you definitely have to maybe, err on a different side of the argument there and look at it in its own specific context. But I think maybe you're right, Eric, when you say adjusting the expectations for Myers Leonard. When you start to look at him as a solid role-playing bench player who can do a few things really well and can help the team at those specific things, I think that's when you kind of really start, to kind of reconcile the fact that he's not going to be, necessarily the starting power forward of the future for the Blazers.
Yeah, and I think that the point you make is a great one, that he should be focusing on those things that he's really good at and maybe build from that foundation and go up. I mean, there's some parts about his game that I wish that he would actually not focus on so much, because I think it would make his decision making matrix a little bit less complex. For example, you get Myers Leonard the ball at the top of the arc and, someone is a couple steps away from him. I'm not sure he should be thinking about the pump fake two dribble drive to the pass. I think he should be thinking just shoot, right? He's super tall. He's 7'1". When he hit, he converted a 4-point play, which is when you get fouled on a 3-point shot. You hit the three and then you make the free throw. And I went back as far as I could tell, and as far back as the records go, he's the tallest NBA player to ever convert a 4-point play in that way. And I wish that he would just focus more on that and less on trying to be a playmaker. That's not, maybe that will be in his wheelhouse at some point. But I mean, if it were me, I would just think, it's like you both said, put a supporting cast around him. Don't expect him to do too much. And I'd just like to see him focus on his shooting for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. And, on the defensive end, as well, it would be nice to see him, kind of slow down a little bit, not try to do too much, just kind of fit within the framework of that team defense. He has the size, he has the mobility, he's shown in spurts that he does have, the skill set to bang with, some of the better offensive centers in the league. He's an effective defender against traditional bigs. So it's I guess that's kind of tying it around to saying, like, yeah, it's a limited skill set. You don't need that every single night for 25, 35 minutes. But if you're talking about a guy you can use against some of the elite bigs in the league when you need him, yeah, that's a great guy, and a guy who can play 20 minutes off the bench, and hit a couple of threes. Like, that's I think that's kind of maybe what the future is for Myers Leonard, unless we see something crazy happen this offseason. I think if we just kind of look at him in that way, it's gonna be a lot more palatable, you know, thinking about maybe the Blazers bringing him back. But I brought up the team defense, and Eric, you talked about this. You wrote for Amico Hoops, I believe, later in the week, talking about the Blazers team defense and how they've really, you know, maybe they've kind of not been playing as well as we've kind of gotten used to them playing at for a certain stretch this season. I think the last couple weeks, we've seen them struggle a little bit with certain teams. Have you noticed any trends that have been happening with the Blazers defensively? Anything that's led to them maybe dropping off a little bit on the defensive end, Eric?
Yeah, and I think it's important to clarify how far they've dropped off. In the month of March, and this is before the New Orleans game, although I don't think it necessarily helped them at all, but anyway, in the month of March, after the Spurs game, they were 29th in defensive rating in the NBA. So they've been not great on defense for the 7 or 8 games in the month of March. One of the things that I've noticed recently, and this was especially true in the Spurs game, was that they're having communication issues. And this is some very basic, like, basketball, team basketball defense 101, where they're not calling out screens. So you'll see they get beat backdoor all the time. And often what happens is one of the wing players will get hung up on a screen, not call for a switch, and then both guys end up guarding the screening player, and the opposing player who was making the cut is wide, wide open. And so Al-Farouq Aminu, for instance, often fails to adjust or often fails to call out screens, unfortunately, not to call him out. Mo Harkless also did it a few times. And so that's been a big issue for them, and that's something they can clear up over the summer. So I'm really optimistic that those types of easy backdoor baskets are fixed in October in the very first preseason game, because that's something that Terry Stotts can drill into them in training camp. I've also noticed that a lot of the perimeter defenders, so this is your Alan Crabb, Gerald Henderson, CJ McCollum, a lot of them get lost when they have to fight their way through multiple screens or follow a dude who's running all over the place, Reggie Miller style. You know, that's one of the reasons why Klay Thompson has burned the Blazers repeatedly this season, is because those guys just tend to lose him when he's running through all those screens.
Yeah, and I mean, I think part of the Blazers' defensive problems, it's not just a system problem. It is an individual defense problem. It's part of it has to come with experience, and especially the Blazers' backcourt, Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum, not the best defenders. And, I mean, there are a couple moments in tonight's game against the Pelican, for example, where you can really look at this was an individual defensive problem that will probably be fixed over time. It's not really a system problem. Where Damian Lillard, I don't remember the specifics of the play and exactly who had the ball, but Damian Lillard is playing defense, and his man was out kind of on the three-point line. And what happened is the ball handler drove into the defense, into the Blazers' defense, and was about to get kind of caught and stuck and trapped. And if you as Damian Lillard are the defender and you're on the guy who's out on the perimeter, your first thought should not be that you're going to help on that on-ball defense. Your first thought should be that the on-ball defense is taken care of. You know, the guy has dribbled into a trap or he's dribbled into a situation where he can't go any further. Your first thought should be, oh man, this guy is going to, you know, make an escape pass and try to get out of the situation he finds himself in. But instead, Damian Lillard went toward the ball. Kind of instinctively, you think, oh, you know, if the ball is stopping, I better go and try to swipe at it and steal it, leaving his defensive assignment wide open on the arc. It led to a wide open shot. And it's just kind of part of it are those little individual defensive things that I think will get cleaned up as the Blazers gain more maturity.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think one of the things I worry about is that there are individual mistakes that all the players are making. And so, unfortunately, I don't know if it's something that they can fix right now. I think it's something they're going to have to fix later on. You know, maybe they can do their best in video sessions to try to get to it, but I don't know if they can. Similar to what you're talking about, I've noticed that when players are playing off the ball, they often zone out James Harden style. Maybe not to the extent of James Harden, but a couple guys definitely have a tendency to take their eye off their man, look directly at the ball, and then realize their guys recognize that and makes an immediate cut towards the hoop or back out towards the three-point line or wherever.
Yeah, it's one of those spatial awareness things when you're playing off ball. At all times, you should be aware of where the hoop is and where the ball is, and you should also have a general idea of where all five players on the opposing team are and where all five players on your team are. You don't need to know exactly where everyone is, but if you see someone leave the periphery on your right side, you should assume that they're probably running behind you on a curl. You shouldn't just be, you know, like a cat, and as soon as it's out of view, you forgot that it's there. Like, you should still be thinking about, wow, those two players, you know, one of them left my left periphery, one of them left my right periphery. They're probably somewhere behind me. You should be aware of that. And that's, Eric, what you're talking about, those James Harden defensive lapses. You see this over and over again. There was a clip going around Twitter yesterday where James Harden was just standing there while his assignment was behind him, cut toward the hoop, was wide open. He laid it in for an easy lane, and James Harden was just kind of standing there like, what just happened? I mean, another part of that too, I mean, you're talking about players at the edge of your periphery. I mean, if you're playing off-ball defense, you don't want your head swiveling from, you know, the ball's being dribbled and it passes and you look this way and you look that way. You want to be keeping track of all of this with your head pretty much stable, everything happening, you know, where you can get a sense of what's happening on the court without moving your head to focus on it. You should be doing that focusing within your own mind. And just to say, this is advice I got from the great Michael Jordan, 21st anniversary of the I'm Back facts, where he came back after a short retirement. There was a VHS video in the mid-90s, Michael Jordan, how do you play defense? And one thing that stuck with me was, you don't want to move your head. You want to be using your periphery as best you can to keep track of all this action. And it's just that spatial awareness, it does come with time, unless you're not paying attention to it. And you talk about a player, you know, who historically has not paid attention to it. That's why you see all these James Harden clips. His spatial awareness on defense is terrible.
So, Brandon, if we're going to talk about the 90s, specifically the mid to late 90s, do you think Jerry Stackhouse had trouble with his defensive technique?
Yes! Jerry Stackhouse makes it into another episode of the Blazers Edge Weekend Podcast. You know what? Stack was a reasonable defender. I mean, he wasn't a sieve on defense. Like, obviously, he's known for his offense. But, Eric, I think we could spend a solid 30 minutes on Jerry Stackhouse, but I'll kick it back to Chris.
Now, he punished other teams. He didn't have to worry about his defense because he was too busy punishing the opposing defense. So shout out for the third time in 4 weeks to Jerry Stackhouse.
Brandon, when it gets to be Christmas time, you're going to have to use the Blazers Edge Twitter account to get Jerry Stackhouse onto the Blazers Edge podcast as a Christmas present for Chris.
Oh, I'm going to get Jerry Stackhouse. I'm going to get Alan Cool Breeze Crab on the podcast. That's going to be my greatest gift to Blazers Edge Weekend podcast host Chris Lucia, would be Cool Breeze on the podcast. I'm working on it.
And the wild one, Mike Rice, eventually needs to come on. So if you're listening to this, Mike, we'd love to have you on the show. Just a quick update here for the listeners, since this is going to be able to come out before any games happen. I'm pretty excited for that. So the Blazers are sixth right now in the West. They're 27 games back from number one there.
Half they could game, still catch up.
Right? Memphis is number five there. They're about 3.5 games up on the Blazers. Houston's in number seven. They're a game and a half behind. They're a half game behind the Blazers, tied in the loss column. Dallas Mavs have one more loss than the Blazers and Rockets. They're a full game and a half behind those two in eighth place. Utah Jazz sitting two games behind the Blazers in ninth place, and then it drops off to the Nuggets there, who are 5.5 games behind the Jazz. So what we're really talking about is that kind of that group there. 6-9, Blazers, Rockets, Mavs, Jazz. You know, if you stretch that out to include the Memphis Grizzlies and the Clippers, it's like no team in that group of the last 10 games has played better than 600 basketball. 6-4 is the best record, which is the Rockets and the Clippers. No team has any better than a 500 record over the last 10 games. I mean, do any of these teams legitimately want to make the playoffs? And I guess the question I want to ask while we're talking about the defense is this something the Blazers can turn around, the woes that we talked about on defense, in time for the playoffs? Or let's say they fall into, you know, or let's say, I guess it doesn't really matter where they fall unless they somehow get up to the fifth seed, which doesn't seem super likely unless Memphis continues on this terrible slide they're on. But Let's just say 6, 7, or 8, right? So they're playing Golden State, San Antonio, or Oklahoma City. Like, I'm looking at these teams and I'm thinking in a 7-game series, all these things that we pointed out, all these defensive lapses, all these predispositions to kind of being, I don't want to say lazy, but kind of not paying necessarily as close attention as you should on defense. You know, a team like the Spurs, the Warriors, it's seven games. They're just going to find those weaknesses, and they're just going to pick them out, right? I mean, what do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, if the Blazers are seeded either seventh or eighth, I think that that's guaranteed they're not making it out of the first round. In fact, they'd probably be fortunate to even win a single game. When you start looking at the sixth seed, if they were to play the Oklahoma City Thunder, I think that is a different story. It's not that the Thunder aren't talented. It's they don't have a system that allows them to reach their full potential, in my view. I mean, when Billy Donovan came in at the beginning of the season, you thought, well, I wonder what's going to be, you know, particularly different about this Thunder team. What's going to be fundamentally different that's going to make them a better team than they were under Scott Brooks? I haven't seen it. They're still an immensely talented team. They're still probably, you know, them and the Cavs, I'm thinking of, that you could just throw a collection of players together with, you know, Westbrook and Durant and pretty much expect right around 60 wins. But that's a team I think the Blazers could find some vulnerability in, because the Blazers do, when they need to, they're very mentally resistant. They can lock down. The Thunder have also been, you know, as advertised, you've probably seen lately how poor the Thunder have been in the fourth quarter. They've been the worst team in the league in the fourth quarter over the last series of weeks. I do think that's a matchup you could definitely find a soft spot in. If you're a Blazers fan, you're probably looking for a sixth seed or above. Seventh or eighth is not going to be a good deal.
I think it's important to, I think too that it's important to recognize that the Blazers have very, very, very little hope of upsetting the Thunder. We saw that in the most recent game in Oklahoma City, that when the Thunder dialed in, they're just heads and shoulders above the 5 through 8 seeds in the West. But they are a step below two of the greatest teams of all time, and so it is a far preferable matchup.
The thing is that, like, I mean, that you just said it. I mean, when the Thunder are dialed in, I mean, it's. I understand for the playoffs, they're probably going to, you know, turn the crank a couple more notches. But I don't know, if you're Kevin Durant, I mean, you know, you're a free agent. Are you looking to stay in Oklahoma City? Is that going to affect how you play in the playoffs? You know, I mean, you could. They are not the same player. I don't think you can draw a direct parallel. But you look at LaMarcus Aldridge and how he played in the playoffs last year. If he knew that he was on his way out the door and he just kind of phoned it in, that could you see the same thing from Kevin Durant? He wouldn't care. I mean, I'm not saying it would happen. I'm only asking the question, like a good journalist does.
I'll put it this way. I think if we were writing the Blazers Edge preview, the three of us were collaborating to write the Blazers Edge preview for a playoff series, we could find an angle where the Blazers could win a few games and scare Oklahoma City. Whereas if we were writing the preview for a series against Golden State or San Antonio, I think the conversation would be, how can we write this without alienating all our readers by being too negative?
Well, it's funny because you think about that first round series last year where the Pelicans played the Warriors, and the Pelicans felt like they really got a victory when they almost won that one game, right? That's exactly what it would feel like as a Blazers fan. If they came close to winning one of those games, it'd feel like a victory of some sort.
You know, when the Blazers were playing the Spurs a couple of years ago in the second round, and we kind of, I don't know what people necessarily expected. I don't think very many people expected them to take that series. I think they expected it to be a little more competitive. I think, like, one of the things I remember writing about in those previews was, when the heck is Terry Stotts going to switch his strategy up? Because I remember games, I think 1 through 3, the Spurs just torched the Blazers in the 14 playoffs with Tony Parker running the pick and rolls, just burning Damian Lillard. And it wasn't until game 4 that Terry Stotts switched Nick Batum onto Tony Parker, slid him down. The Blazers were able to actually steal a game. They didn't change, you know, the way that series went, obviously, but they definitely made it a little more competitive for those last couple of games. So that's definitely, you know, definitely one question I would tend to ask is, you know, where can Terry Stotts find a way to switch things up, and is he willing to switch things up? I think that's something interesting going into the playoffs. If he's going to stick with the same strategy that he's been going with all year, I mean, we'll talk about this another time. Does Noah Vonleh start in the playoffs? I mean, there's so much you can talk about.
Yeah, for sure. And it's funny because you think about this season in particular, Terry Stotts is being forced to use tons of different lineups. I mean, you even look at the Noah Vonleh starting at power forward thing. It's kind of like Terry Stotts is getting a free pass to try some stuff out, try some different rotations. I'm going to have Myers start. I'm going to have Myers come off the bench and be the first person off the bench. I'm going to have Alan Crabb be, you know, one of our main contributors. I'm going to switch out Myers for Mo Harkless. I'm going to have Gerald Henderson take over for a little bit. I mean, you have a Blazers team which by necessity has to find different ways to win, which is very different from the team they've been the last couple of years with LaMarcus Aldridge, Nick Batum, Wesley Matthews, Damian Lillard. You knew exactly what you were getting and how you were going to get it. So, I mean, Terry Stotts as a coach has been forced by necessity because of the nature of his lineup, has been forced to be a little bit more creative. Is that going to be helpful come playoff time? It could be. I mean, I'm not saying that this is the year that the Blazers are ready to make a run because it's pretty clear that it's not. But I do think this is a very interesting year for the Blazers because they are better than expected. They are a relatively decent team, and they do by necessity because they don't have a clear-cut lineup either, you know, even from the starters or off the bench, that you do have to be a little bit more creative, more adaptive, and that is definitely helpful come playoff time.
Yeah, I certainly can't wait to see it. I mean, I definitely think that the playoffs are going to be a really good opportunity for the Blazers to try some things out to where they have, you know, between 4 and 7 games to kind of throw stuff out there and see what works. And when you really, you know, when you're kind of coming from the place that they are, let's say they end up in the 7th or 8th seed, hypothetically, and you kind of know you're not necessarily going to win, do you throw stuff out there that is a bit non-conventional? Do more kind of stretch lineups or small ball lineups or play guys who hadn't played necessarily a ton during the season? I mean, there's so many opportunities there to counter and recounter and see how effective those things are against a really good team. So we have about a dozen games left. I think that we should probably have Eric on in the next several weeks here. I think it's going to be 3-4 weeks till the playoffs start. So it looks like, you know, right now, unless the Jazz really pick things up, it looks like the Blazers are going to probably fall in that 6th, 7th, or 8th seed and end up in the playoffs. So we're going to have plenty to talk about, but we're kind of up against the clock here. So I want to say thanks, Eric Griffith, for coming back, man. It's been a pleasure. This has got to be 5th, 6th, or 7th time. You're always welcome back. We'll have you again closer to the playoffs, man.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Thanks a lot, Brandon. A pleasure as always, and I look forward to the Blazers making an unexpected playoff run.
All right, we've come to the end of episode 121 of the Blazers Edge podcast. I'd like to thank you very much for joining us. I'd also like to thank Blazers Edge staff writer Eric Griffith for coming on the show.
And as always, our intro and outro music was provided by Odar. You can check out his stuff at soundcloud.com/Odar Beats. And please tune in early next week for the Blazers Edge midweek podcast with Dave Deckard and Phil Masons. For Chris Lucia, I'm Brandon Goldner, and may your laundry always be fresh.